Okay, so our Bible reading so far takes us up from in the Old Testament through chapter 15 of Deuteronomy, and in the New Testament through chapter 14. And so so we start off with a question. So why don't we just turn to Mark 14, and we'll talk about strange situation. Mark chapter 14, verse 48. So this is when Judas brings all of the chief priests, the elders, all of their henchmen with them. And verse 47 says, "One of them that stood by drew a sword and smote a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." And isn't it interesting as well that last time we talked about that Mark is probably getting most of his, or a lot of his information from Peter. And so in a lot of ways, Mark is Peter's gospel, but it doesn't name this. Now, if we read the other gospels, we know that this is Peter who does this, but Mark doesn't name him. He just says it's one of them. And he cut off his ear. Jesus answered and said unto them, "Are you come out as against a thief with swords and staves to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you took me not. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." And they all forsook him and fled. Isn't it interesting that Mark doesn't take time to tell us that Jesus went ahead and put Malchus's ear back on? Because the other gospel writers tell us who had the sword, who cut his ear off, whose ear got cut off, and that Jesus went ahead and patched it up, which is just, it just cracks me up. I mean, it's just fascinating, you know, his mercy even in the midst of that. And they're all sitting there, they're going to get him, you know, "Oh, we hate this guy." And he heals this guy. They all sit there and watch Peter just slices the side of his head off, you know. And Jesus just puts it back on. And, you know, they don't, and nobody's like, you know, that. If I had been there, I'd be like, "I ain't touching it. I'm going to go," right? So he says, "Are you come out as against a thief with swords and with staves to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching. You took me not, but the scriptures must be fulfilled." And they all forsook him and fled. And there followed him a certain young man, having a linen cloth cast about his naked body. And the young men laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. So several folks were asking, "What's up with this?" And I don't know exactly, but my guess is that that's Mark. That his mother's house was very close to the Garden of Gethsemane, which was one of those places that it was easy when Peter, in Acts, Peter gets out of prison, that's where he's going, is to Mark's mother's house. So it's just across the valley from the temple area. And so it's right on the outskirts of the old city of Jerusalem. So I'm thinking Mark's in bed. He hears the commotion. He gets up. You know, I don't know about you, but you don't wear the same kind of clothes when you're asleep that you do during the day. So he's and when he says that he's naked, that could definitely mean that he had his knickers on and he just had his sheet that he was sleeping with, right? So I'm not thinking he was, you know, it's a difference between naked and buck naked, right? You can still have your socks on if you're just naked. So he probably had his knickers on, and he has this linen sheet wrapped around him. He hears the commotion. He gets up out of bed, goes outside, sees all this going on. And in all the commotion, somebody tries to grab him. And when they do, well he runs. But I think that's Mark. That's what a lot of commentators think as well. So who knows? Someday we get to heaven and we're going, "All right, Lord, who's the naked guy?" Right? So anyway. But a good question, very, very interesting, strange situation. But I think, why would that be included? I think it's included because I think this is Mark's personal testimony here. He doesn't say, "This is me." He kind of throws this in his third person kind of situation. But I think what this keeps him from... He's telling the story as much as he's got it, but there's not as much detail here, like I said, as there are in some of the other gospel accounts. So he's telling the detail that he's got. Now, he's got a full hand account from Peter, which is interesting because in Mark, it tells us that the cock crew multiple times and exactly how it happens. And the other gospel writers just talk about a cock crowing, and some of them do different things with that, but Old Peter, he spelled this last part of this chapter out very, very specifically for Mark, because I'm sure that's probably that's the low point of Peter's life right there. So, anyway. So, other questions in Deuteronomy or Mark up through this point? Did y'all pick up? I asked my kids this. Did you pick up the fact that as you read Deuteronomy, you learn that there's two of something that you thought there was only one of? Anybody catch that? What?
Just Exodus all over.
Okay, so all right. So a lot of things in Deuteronomy are a repeat of Exodus. The Ten Commandments and many of the laws, which is, by the way, what Deuteronomy means. Deuteronomos is the Latin word for it, and it means the second law. So it is a repeat. Actually, Deuteronomy is some sermons, is what it is. And it's Moses' kind of last opportunity, so he preaches to them one more time. And Deuteronomy and Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus are kind of like bookends. So Exodus tells us the story up to through the Exodus. So, and Leviticus and then Numbers tells us the story of the wilderness wandering, and then Deuteronomy at the end. So you get the law at the beginning at Sinai, and then at the end of the 40 years, you get Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy is taking place at the end of the wilderness wanderings in the plains of Moab, right before they're going to cross and go into. But specifically. But by the way, is there anywhere else in the Bible that we get the same story more than once?
Gospels.
Kings and the Chronicles and parts of Samuel. There's some of the Psalms that we find in the books of Samuel that are repeated in the Psalms. A lot of the things are repeated as far as that goes or referenced. But God doesn't. He doesn't leave a whole lot for room for mistakes for us, I think, is the thing. And let every word be established by the mouth of two or three witnesses. In the gospel accounts, we have four witnesses. So we do have a lot of repetitive things coming from different angles in the situation, in the Word of God. So, that is true. But there's two arcs. Did anybody pick up on that? That there's two arcs? Two arcs of the covenant. So Deuteronomy tells us that Moses built the ark. And Exodus told us who built the ark. Ark of the Covenant, not Noah's Ark. Who built the fancy one?
Noah.
Right, the craftsmen, Bezalel and Aholiab, right? And he has specific instructions for this thing. But Moses built an ark, a very plain one, a wooden one. The one Bezalel and Aholiab build is going to be ornate. It's going to be built of wood, but this will be covered with gold. It's going to have staves to carry it. It's going to have cherubim, beaten, hammered work into the top of it. I mean, it's a fancy deal. But Moses actually built a box, acacia wood box, himself, to carry the Ten Commandments in. So Moses has his box, and then Bezalel and Aholiab build another box for the ark. The ark will rest in more than one tent. Did you pick up as you read through the books of Exodus and Numbers that there's more than one? There's a tabernacle of the congregation before there's a tabernacle. Once again, that's a tent that Moses pitched, and he and Joshua would go, and he set it outside of the camp. So Moses would go and he would spend time in that tent. He would pray in that tent. Joshua would sit there at the door and he would wait upon him. And then later they get the information on how to build the actual tabernacle, which sits in the midst of the camp, but the one that was out there. Later on, after this, the ark's going to rest in several different places, and it's going to bounce around from one place to another. And then David is going to pitch a tent for the ark once he brings it to Jerusalem, until Solomon builds the temple. So there's multiple boxes for the Ten Commandments. There's several different tabernacles of the congregation. There's a makeshift one at the beginning. So I find that fascinating. What else? Any questions about Deuteronomy? By the way, I like Deuteronomy. But as Natalie pointed out, it pretty much is a review of a lot of things. So I tell you what, let's go through our summary right quick. We'll do a little bit of talking about Deuteronomy. If you think of something else, we'll shoot. Here's a little outline. Basically, it's three sermons. So the first one goes up through middle of chapter 4, and it's basically Moses talking about what God has done. What's interesting to me about this is once you get into this section right here on the conquest of East Jordan, you learn that everybody they ran into were giants. They've got different names for them, every different group that has them, but every single one of those groups. And let's look at that real quick because I find that really interesting. In Deuteronomy chapter 2, it says there in verse 10, it says, the Emims dwelt there in times past, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims. Now, if we look over in chapter 1, verse 28, the spies, it's a reminder of the spies bringing back the bad report, said the people is greater and taller than we, the cities are walled up to heaven, and moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakims there. So, we have this name, Anakims. These were the group of people that the Israelite spies saw when they went into the land. They were scared to death of them because they said they were giants. Then in verse 10, it says there's a group of people called the Emims. They dwelt in times past, great people, great many and tall as the Anakims. So you know, how tall was Goliath? Well, he was over 9 feet tall. So we're not just talking about, you know, some basketball players. We're talking about giants. In verse 20 of chapter 2, it says that also was accounted a land of giants. Giants dwelt there in old time, and the Ammonites called them Zamzumims. What a name. A people great and many and tall as the Anakims, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they succeeded them and dwelt in their stead. So we see at least three groups of people here that are referred to by different names, and some of them have already been wiped out by the time the Israelites get there, but others of them are still there. So when they fight Og, for instance, it's going to tell how big his bed was. And the thing's huge. It's 13 feet long. Wouldn't that be great? I'm going to tell you what. Now, that would be a bed that you could get some sleep on, you know. Like four of you could just lay like this on that thing. And so when you think of it, and all of this is a conquest that takes place before they ever cross the Jordan, before they ever get into the land of Canaan, they are already fighting these giants and just mopping them up, you know. Of course, God has promised that if they'll be faithful to Him, He'll give them victory. And so it doesn't matter who they encounter; they're gonna whip them. But I find that fascinating in that first part of Deuteronomy. I got to tell you, I grew up going to church, and I never heard anybody ever talk about no giant besides Goliath as the only one. I mean, I remember the day that I realized that he had brothers. And I'm like, well, where did that come from? You know. Now, whose fault was that? That's my fault because I had never read this book. But when I sit down and read this book, I'm like, wait a minute. There's all kinds of giants around. Yep. There were. So then we have the first sermon, which goes through chapter 4, and he just kind of talking about how they got to that point. Okay. Once we get to the second sermon, to Moses' second sermon here, he's going to go through the law. This is where we're going to have a rerun of the Ten Commandments and then a whole bunch of additional laws and the way that all that plays out. And you're right, Natalie, it is a big rerun of a lot of the things. But much like things that are here, you're going to gain a little bit more information about them. And so you got to take Exodus, and you got to take Leviticus, and you got to take Deuteronomy. You got to put them all together to get the whole story. And we also see how, in the process of all this, we're working some things out. Like, for instance, Zelophehad's daughters, right? So he's got these five daughters. He doesn't have any sons. He's getting old. the daughters come to Moses and they say, hey, we want an inheritance in the land, because if you don't give us an inheritance, my father's name will die out. And so Moses says, all right, let me talk to God about it. God says, she's right. You know, they're right. This is what you should do. So he says, okay, so if a man dies and he doesn't have any sons, then inheritance will pass to daughters. And so the guys all get to sitting around. By the way, this is where lawyers come from, okay? The guys are sitting around, they're thinking. They're going, now, wait a minute. So if these girls are from Manasseh, I can't remember, what tribe is Zelophehad had from? Is it from Judah? Which one? Somebody find it. Anyway, doesn't matter. Whatever tribe he's from, his girls are going to get this inheritance in the tribe. And then they're going to marry a guy from Judah. And this guy from Judah is going to wind up with an inheritance that should have been from someone in our tribe. And then our tribe, and after a while, it'll all be whittled up. So they come back to Moses. They say, hey, Moses, what about this? Moses says, that's a good point. Let me talk to God. God says, they speak right. That's exactly right. That is what will happen. So here's the way you fix that. These girls, they do get an inheritance within their father's house, but they have to marry within their tribe if they want that inheritance. Now, I suppose they could have married outside of their tribe if they wanted to, but they wouldn't have gained their father's inheritance if that were the case. They would have passed to another sister or another near kinsman or whoever. You know. And so he establishes this whole hierarchy of who gets your stuff. Which, by the way, is already in practice in many ways, because who was Abraham's heir before Isaac was born? A feller named Eleazar of Damascus. Not even kin. He was a servant of Abraham's. And so, because Abraham didn't have a near kinsman, that inheritance was going to pass to Eleazar. So some of these are tribal customs of that day and time. So, you find out things like that. And you know, to me, yeah.
Okay, why would Lot have been considered a near kinsman?
He would have, but we're under the new law. Under the old law, this is the way it was all going to shake out. Lot was getting his father's inheritance, and Abraham was going to pass his on to
the servant.
To his servant, yeah. So God, he codifies all that. So you've got, like I say, this is where lawyers come from. If you're ever just bored, you should get a copy of the Talmud. Realize when you get it, don't believe a word it says. But just look at, especially in the Mishnah, to see how ingenious the people were at taking something that the Bible said and then just opening up 10 million different directions from it. I mean, they're genius. I mean, it's ingenious. It's foolishness. It's not what God wanted, and it's going to lead the people so far astray, it's not even funny. But this is where lawyers come from. They sit down, and they think about things, and they find loopholes, and they figure stuff out. And these guys were good at it. They were really good at it. By the way, in the book, yeah, shoot.
Manasseh.
Okay, they were from Manasseh. Thank you. So Zelophehad was from Manasseh. And so which side of the creek did they get their inheritance on? Because Manasseh was split in two, right? Half the tribe. That's another thing we learn is that two and a half tribes decide that they don't want to go into Canaan. They want to take their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan River, in the land of the Amorites, where they whooped all these giants and all these people, and they said, "Man, this is cow country. We got lots of cattle. We'll just take our inheritance here." Now, what's the problem with that? Whenever they say that. Right. Moses says, well, that's not fair. So you're going to take your inheritance here, and your brothers are going to have to go fight a war against the Canaanites on the other side. So they say, well, I tell you what we'll do. We'll leave our families here, and we'll go. We'll send all the men. We'll go fight, and we'll stay until the battle is completely finished. When every other tribe has their inheritance, we'll come back to our families. And that's what they do. And it causes great problems, though. There's nothing but problems. And it's one of those times when I think they messed up big time. I don't think they should have done that. I think that they compromised by doing that. And why did they compromise? Same thing with Abraham and Lot, right? Lot lifted up his eyes and he looked and he saw the plain and the cities of the plain. And what did he see? It was well watered and it was good grazing for cattle. That's what's wrong with Oklahoma. People from eastern New Mexico, West Texas go to Oklahoma. They see green grass. They go, oh, they moved to Oklahoma. They have a 60-day drought. They go broke. They have to come back. It happens all the time. So, what God expected of Israel. We talked more about the laws, the second sermon. Then finally, the third sermon is the last part, and it's the ratification of the covenant. So Moses is wrapping everything up and talking about how everything's going to come together. And then the last few chapters is the transition of leadership in Israel. And it's going to transition because Moses is the very last one of that old group except Joshua and Caleb. That he's the last one that hasn't died yet. Aaron's already dead. His son has replaced him. And so Moses is going to anoint Joshua to be their leader. He's going to lay down and die, and the devil's going to want his body. Isn't that interesting? We don't learn about that until we come to the New Testament. So, that's Deuteronomy. A couple of neat things about Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is cited more than 80 times in the New Testament. It is the most often cited. Isaiah and a few of the prophets get in there pretty close, but Jesus cited Deuteronomy more than any other of the Old Testament books in his own preaching. 17 of the 27 books have a reference, either directly or indirectly, to the book of Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy is super important to our understanding of the New Testament because it's going to be referenced so many times. The date, if you want a date for the writing of Deuteronomy, it's going to be, I don't know about the writing, but its actual setting is 1451 B.C. Remember, we're working with a 1491 Exodus, so 40 years later in 1451 in the plains of Moab east of Jericho. In the New Testament, we see, we haven't quite made it there yet, but there's a real interesting passage that we're going to read tomorrow in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 15. And it says, "The Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren like unto me. Unto him ye shall hearken." This is one of those huge statements that... and one of the reasons why Deuteronomy is so important, because the Israelites, they read that, and so from the day that Moses died, they went to looking for somebody like Moses. And he doesn't come. You got Elijah, you got Elisha, you got prophets, you got kings, you got all kinds of stuff going on, but you don't have them. When Jesus comes into, in John chapter 4, when Jesus comes to Jacob's well, and the woman of Samaria, he meets her. She asks him this question, "Are you that prophet?" Because see, the Samaritans, they would have read and believed the first five books. They didn't believe any of the prophets or the writings or anything else, but they held to the Pentateuch, the first five books. So she knew of this. "Are you that prophet?" You know, that was John the Baptist. "Are you the one we're looking for, or is somebody else coming?" So it's a messianic prophecy is what it is. Someone like Moses. By the way, what was Jesus' very first miracle? Turn the water into wine, didn't he? And Moses' very first plague brought up on Egypt was turning the water into blood. And so there are a ton. You know, Moses goes up on the mountain how many times? At least two times and fasts for 40 days back to back to get the law, right? Jesus goes into the wilderness and he fasts for 40 days. You know, there's a ton. When you take this verse and you start looking, you see that Jesus he's fulfilling this for the people, that he is this prophet. By the way, guess who Islam says that is? They say that's Muhammad. They say that right there is a reference to Muhammad. So, anyway. The key word, I would say, if you want a key word in this particular book, I would say it's covenant. The idea of the covenant being brought up time and time again. the statutes and the ordinances and the regulations and the laws and all of these things that, that God has given to them, but it's all about covenant. When Jesus had his confrontation with Satan in the wilderness, all three times Satan tempted him, he countered with Scripture, and all three times he quoted from the book of Deuteronomy as he did that. So it's the record of the renewal of the old covenant given at Mount Sinai. But that's basically what this is. The covenant was given at Sinai to the old generation. The old generation rebelled against God and disobeyed. God cursed them, said they all had to die out. So they wandered for 40 years in the wilderness till they all died. So now this is their children. And he even says it at the beginning. You know, at Kadesh Barnea, the spies, they came back and they gave a bad report. When they did, the people said, us and our children are going to be a prey. We go into this land, our children are going to be a prey. And so Moses brings that up 40 years later. He said, you guys are the ones that your daddy said were going to be a prey. But you're the ones that are going to go in and take the land. So since this is a new generation, let's go over it again one more time before we go in. Really, really smart plan too, by the way. So it's this renewal of the covenant. We've got those three sermons. Kind of go through that. In the last part in Sermon 3, Moses basically gives us a summary of world history to come. And he predicts what will befall Israel in the future. So in this section right here. And there's blessings, there's curses. And then he even talks about the diaspora. And the diaspora is the scattering of Israel to the nations. So he doesn't say if this happens, he says when this happens. So once again, if a Jew had been reading their Bible, and they read Deuteronomy, they knew that there was going to come a time that they were going to be booted out of the land. And that's exactly what happened. The dispersion among the nations. Oh, by the way, they also knew that after they had been dispersed, that they would return. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. You've got two times that Israel gets kicked out of the land. Okay, one time is the Babylonian exile. But Israel wasn't dispersed to the nations when that happens. Okay, Israel was sent to one nation. They all went to Babylon, all of them. And so while in Babylon, they had to remain there for 70 years because they didn't let the land lay out a Sabbath. We just read about sabbatical years in the book of Deuteronomy. They were to farm the land for 6 years, and the seventh year you let it lay fallow. You don't harvest it for gain. You can graze off of it, but you don't harvest it for gain. The next year you replant, and the next year you start, you go into another 6 years. And God said, if you'll do this, I'll give you enough your sixth year to last until you get grain off of it again. For 490 years, Israel never obeyed that command. Never. Not one time did they ever let the land lie fallow. Why do you think that is? A lack of faith? Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that's always the reason.
If you're a farmer and you're thinking, I'm not going to plant anything for a year.
Agreed.
I would say greed, too.
Yep. We just approved the farm bill. You know what's interesting is it would have been fascinating to have seen what would have happened to that land. Now, it's not a fair test because God promises them. He says, you know, when you were in Egypt, you farmed differently than this. Egypt is it's an alluvial plain. It's a flood valley. You plant based on the flood of a river. Here is a place where you rely upon rainfall. And I will take care of this land. Isn't that amazing? What would have been fascinating to me is to see. But by the way, when you think of Israel, what's the picture that forms in your mind? What does it look like? As a country.
Children's book. It's all grassy green, blue skies.
Okay.
Kermit, Texas, I think. Jowl and Kermit.
Jowl and Kermit. Without as many mosquitoes, maybe. Yeah, hill country. The Negev. When I think of Israel, I think of the Negev. That's the southern part, and it is absolute pure desert. Rocks and scorpions and dirt, and that's it. Right? But Interestingly, Israel produces all of the cut flowers for Europe. Every single day, a 747 flies cut flowers to London, England. Bananas. Just pick your crop. Wheat, corn, barley, every kind of sorghum you could possibly imagine. In Galilee, in the area around the Sea of Galilee, it is unbelievably fertile land. Now, the Negev is, it's dry, but that's just that south portion down there. When you get into the central part of the country, it is a breadbasket. And it would be fascinating to me to have seen what it would have looked like had they let it lie out and lie fallow like God said to do, if they had done that. But because he didn't, he gave them 490 years, and then he said, okay, I'm going to get all my Sabbaths at one time. So you all get out, go to Babylon. 70 years you stay there. At the end of 70 years, I'll bring you back. But that's only one nation, right? In the book of Deuteronomy, Moses says that you're going to be scattered to the nations. So this is why 1948 and the Balfour Declaration is such a huge thing, because it was actually prophesied in the book of Deuteronomy that when Israel was scattered to the nations, that they would return to their homeland. I mean, do we have a Philistine homeland or a Hittite homeland or an Amorite homeland or pick your extinct people, right? We don't have those things. Israel belonged to the Romans, then it belonged to the Ottomans, then was divided into 14 different sections and all kinds of different things, and it was passed back and forth and around and through. And even today, you've got portions of the city that are still divided up in disputed territory and portions of the country. But in 1948, and if you've never read it, you really should read it. I can't remember whether it was Truman. Who was the president in 1948? Is it Eisenhower? Is it Truman?
Truman?
I think it was Truman. Read the story of what happened. Truman was against it. And there was a man in one of his cabinet members that was a Christian, and he came in and he sat down with the president, and he brought another man that was a Jewish man or a Jewish Christian, and they all sat down together. And they had a little meeting, and they basically got a Bible out and said, Mr. President, that land belongs to Israel. That land is God's. God gave that to Israel thousands of years ago, and it's theirs. And here's the prophecy regarding this, and here's what the Jordanians are going to do, and here's what, you think that we got problems with Muslims. They had huge problems with Muslims then at the time. And when they left that meeting, he changed his mind, picked up the phone, and called, and he said, I'm in for this deal. And when the United States president said he was in, well, then the rest of it was the League of Nations or whatever prior to all of that. This council, this post-World War II council that was doing this, they said, United States president is in on this deal. Let's do it. That's enough to throw us over the top. You want to talk about a hated piece of legislation. When they passed that, the people began to come back in there. They said that for days, once they started that migration back into the land, that 747s landed every 10 minutes with Jews from all over the world coming back into the land of Israel. They were all communists. They all came from communist countries, had communist ideologies. They all came from Poland and Russia and everywhere. There's still more live in this country than live in Israel. So they set up a communist form of government. They still kind of have that today. But they made them all live in kibbutzes. They had to live in a kibbutz until they learned the law, learned how to speak Hebrew, and until they could support themselves. And once they learned those things, then they could. The kibbutz is a communal, it's a commune, it's a hippie commune for Jews, is what it is. And so they lived in that situation until they could speak Hebrew and move out of there and start their deal and start a earning and gainful employment and productive citizen and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what a great idea. What a great way to handle immigration, massive immigration on a huge scale. You know, just to take care of learning the language. By the way, can't make Aliyah unless you speak what? Hebrew to this day. You also can't be a citizen unless you can prove that you are Israeli. But anyway, and they got big walls everywhere. They got all kinds of things. But so, Okay, so that's Deuteronomy in a nutshell. Once again, some magnificent things that we learned about God. So as we've been talking, any questions, anything you thought of that you ran across while you were reading that struck you?
I had a question from Mark.
Okay.
Mark 9:19, like that story with the, the demonic boy was cured and that kind of stuff. But his response to when the disciples or his father came and asked him to heal him, and it was just almost like a sigh, like, oh goodness, why do I have to do this? It was almost like he did it begrudgingly. In a sense, but I know other parts of the Bible, he, has compassion and that kind of stuff. I'm just like, what makes it different when he encounters it, where it's almost like, why do you guys have no faith, but he does anyway? And then when he's like, oh yeah, I'll definitely, take care of this for you type thing.
Right.
What's the difference?
Okay, look at verse 14 right quick. And that's a good question. By the way, we talked about a few weeks ago the Syrophoenician woman. He basically calls her a dog. he does some strange things. Of all the people that have ever walked this planet, I think the one who let the most people down is Jesus. He would not do what they wanted him to do. He would not be what they wanted him to be. But look at verse 14. He says, when he came to his disciples, and think about the setting of this too, Juliet, because they have just come down from the Mount of Transfiguration, right? So Peter, James, John, they have just seen him transformed into what he probably looks like after the resurrection or something like that. So they've had this incredible mountaintop experience, heard the voice of God. They're walking about that high off the ground. They come walking down into a big argument. And verse 14 says, and when he came to his disciples, he saw a great multitude about them, and the scribes questioning with them. So they've got an argument between his disciples and the scribes. And the scribes are the lawyers that I'm talking about. These guys are they are probably primarily from the Pharisees, but they are always separated from them. These are the guys that are keeping the law. And it says, straightway all the people, when they beheld him, were greatly amazed, running to him, saluted him. And he asked the scribes what question he was. He didn't ask his disciples, he asked the scribes, what are y'all arguing about? And one of the multitude answered and said, Master, I have brought unto thee my son. So this guy, he just jumps out there and he just answers the question. So he tells the story. And so that's the point that he answers with this. Oh, faithless generation. How long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him unto me. And he begins to ask him the question. So I think the reason for his exasperation is because of the pandemonium that's going on. So his disciples are arguing with the scribes. He asks this particular, somebody from the crowd interrupts him. It's just this massive mess, And he just, look what an army I fight for, right? I can't believe I have to put up with all of this. So then he goes to the inquiry and everything. And verse 24, I think, is my favorite, one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible. He says, I believe, help my unbelief. I find myself to be like that a lot of times, especially when I'm praying for something that's seeming impossible, Lord, I won't believe. I want to believe. Help me, right? So I like this dad. This dad is very honest. So I think the reason for I don't think it's that he doesn't have compassion for this child.
So it was more like the argument and like those people more than like the person and like this that he was like the father and the son.
I think so. I think it's the crowd and the mess, and I also think it's his disciples, because in verse 29. Or verse 28 and 29, they want to know, hey, we've already done this before. How come we couldn't do this now? And he says, well, this kind can come forth by nothing but prayer and fasting, and which is something he'd been doing because him and Peter and James and John been up on top of the mountain, and they come back down into this. So yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with him with the child or even the dad and his and then the situation. I think it has to do more with the mess that, you know, because he tried real hard to keep his disciples from arguing with, you know, just mm-hmm. kept them. He tried to keep them out of that kind of stuff. Because and here they are in this big, you know. So that's what I think. But it's a great question. So any other questions, ideas, thoughts?
One of the things I found interesting in Deuteronomy was when he told them, he said, I'm not doing this because of your righteousness or because of your goodness. He says, I am destroying the people in the land because of their unrighteousness.
Absolutely. That's in chapter 8, and that is a really, 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 really important aspect. Johnny and I had talked about this several weeks ago. How do you talk to somebody who says, you guys are Christians, you believe the Bible? Well, that Bible tells about a God who committed genocide. I mean, he just wiped people out. And he did. When the Israelites came in, you know, Jericho, it is a whole burnt offering to God. Kill them all. Kill the men, women, and children. Kill them all. Burn it to the ground. Don't take anything out of it. They were to show no mercy to the Canaanite peoples as they went in. And the answer to that question is found, I think, in Deuteronomy 8 as well as other places. But the Israelites happened to be God's judgment upon those Canaanite tribes because of their wickedness. Because they were wicked to the core in every way imaginable. They they were idolaters. Their detestable practices. I mean, he tells them, he says, you break down their altars. You know, here a few years ago, Muslims were in trouble because they were blowing up UNESCO World Heritage sites, right? So in other words, they had some big Buddhist carvings in the side of a cliff, and a bunch of Wahhabis went in there and blew them up. And I'm going, that doesn't surprise me. That's idolatry. You know, they don't go for idolatry, and so it doesn't surprise me they did that. Boy, as the world was in an uproar, you know. Oh, you can't destroy this heritage, you know. That's what God told them to do. Break down their altars, cut down their groves, kill all it, don't take any of their spoil, don't burn it all up, get rid of it. Because if you don't, you bring that nifty little fat Buddha belly home with you, and it's going to captivate you. And you bring that wife who worships that fat Buddha baby home with you, and she's going to captivate you. And the next thing you know, you're going to be worshiping those gods. And that's exactly what they did. They weren't the hammer of God like they were supposed to be. But I think that's how you answer the question of supposed genocide is, you know, I mean, if we were to think about God's providence, you know, there have been a lot of nations that have been the broadsword of God to bring judgment upon. I mean, he's going to use the Babylonians, he's going to use the Assyrians to be the judgment upon his own people. Then a few years later, he's going to use the Babylonians to bring judgment upon his own people. Then he's going to use the Persians to show grace to his people. And then he's going to use the Romans to come and devastate his people. And then he's going to, you know, and if we were to carry on with that, we've been the broadsword of God. We broke the back of the Bushido code in the Japanese culture. Gone forever. Never will return again. Because we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You say, well, did God do that? Well, I don't know. But it sure happened, you know. And we ought to think, I think we ought to think real hard about that, because I'm not real sure. There's not large sections of the United States population that are just as wicked as the Canaanites were in that day. I mean, one of the things he says, you know, they're idolaters, and they worship idols, and they have these detestable practices, and they even make their children to pass through the fire. And I'm going, good Lord, that's us. That's America. So if China uses, if God uses China as the broadsword to bring us to our knees, it would not surprise me not one little bit. And we don't deserve anything. As a nation, we deserve absolutely nothing from God. Everything that we have is a gift, and a gift of his grace, and it's amazing. It's amazing what America has been and even could be. But I don't think God puts up with detestable practices. And he'll put up with it for a pretty good while before he finally does something about it. I would say that the United States of America at this point is living on borrowed time. We desperately need to repent. So, as we end, I just want to encourage you. Pray for our nation. My goodness. Pray every time you think about it. You know, it's easy to sit back, and I'm bad about this. It's easy to sit back and point out everything that's wrong. But let that drive you to prayer, because, you know, praying people hold back the wrath of God a lot of times. And I don't want to see this country come under God's judgment. I don't want to see that. I would like to see this country have a revival and return to the Lord and do something that we've never done before. Wouldn't that be great? It'd be wonderful. So, let me pray for you.